All right, let's go ahead and take out our Bibles tonight, and we're going to turn together to Ecclesiastes 8 again. And we've been in this passage for a little bit of time, and so we're going to read the last part of chapter 8. So this is verses 9 through 14, and our topic tonight is learning to submit to God when life is unpredictable. Learning to submit to God when life is unpredictable. Okay, verse number 9 says this, "All this have I seen and applied my heart unto every work that is done under the sun. There is a time wherein one man ruleth over another to his own hurt. And so I saw the wicked buried, who had come and gone from the place of the holy, and they were forgotten in the city where they had so done. This is also vanity. Because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Though a sinner do evil 100 times and his days be prolonged, yet surely I know that it shall be well with them that fear God, which fear before him. But it shall not be well with the wicked, neither shall he prolong his days, which are as a shadow, because he feareth not before God. There is a vanity which I've done upon the earth, that there be just men unto whom it happeneth according to the work of the wicked. Again, there be wicked men in whom it happeneth according to the work of the righteous. I said that this also is vanity." Now, for us to appreciate and understand what is being communicated in these verses, we have to kind of set them in the general context of chapter 8. So let me give you a summary statement and then kind of remind you again of what is the main topic in these verses leading up to verses 9 through 14, our focus tonight. The summary is this: learning to relate properly to authority is difficult because sometimes people in authority make decisions or allow matters to unfold in ways that we do not understand. I'm going to say that again. Learning to relate properly to authority is difficult because sometimes people in authority make decisions or allow matters to unfold in ways that we do not understand. Now, I want to pause for just a moment and make a little clarification here. That statement is true if we're talking about human authorities. It's also true if we're talking about the ultimate authority, God himself. However, there is a difference between human authority and God's authority. Human authority is being executed by a flawed individual. So sometimes the reason we don't understand the decision that a human authority makes is because nobody should understand it. It was a poor decision, okay? There are situations like that. Sometimes leaders make bad choices. They don't handle things the right way, okay? As a mom, I'm sure that you've handled every single situation correctly in your home, right? Not a chance, okay? As a dad or as a husband, I'm sure you've handled every single situation correctly, right? Not a chance. As a pastor, I'm sure I've handled every single situation correctly, right? Wrong. As human authorities, we are flawed people. We make decisions sometimes and we're wrong. But I want you to realize something. God makes decisions sometimes that we don't get to. In fact, he does it a lot. And God's never wrong. So sometimes this concept of struggling with authority isn't just about the authority making a poor choice. Sometimes it's actually about us. It's about our willingness to submit to God's structure. And so I want you to recognize that when we're looking at these verses, this issue of authority is something where Solomon has moved from like the human realm where we're dealing with other people who are flawed individuals, and he's moving from that to God himself. You know how many people don't believe in God? They're agnostic, and it's got nothing to do with them rationally coming to the conclusion that this kind of a world could never be created by a real God. It just has to be random chance that created it. You know how they often come to that conclusion? It's not reason. Bitterness. And the bitterness is against God. There's something in their life that didn't flush out the way that they believed it should have, where they witnessed some event that they could not make sense of. And all of a sudden they began to go, if that can happen in this world, then there's no way that I can accept that this world was created by God and that he is good and that he's all wise and that he's all powerful. And so at the root of that rejection of God is a bitterness because we've seen situations we can't make sense of. What's interesting is that these verses really fall into that frame of mind. So when I talk about authority in these verses, and we talk about how relating to authority is hard because sometimes we don't understand the decisions that are made or the way things are going to be allowed to unfold, I want you to think in the context of our relationship to the highest authority, God Himself. He is sovereign, He is good, He is all wise, He is just, and even if we can't make sense of what He allows, He still is those things. So God wants us to be a people who submit to Him in humility when we see difficult matters unfold. And in these verses, we're going to see examples of difficulties that Solomon observed and that, you know, we observe them as well. And really, some of the things we're going to talk about today are some of the very things that people will allow to create this root of bitterness in their heart toward God, and ultimately they'll create God in their own image, or they'll reject Him as He is and say, I don't believe in Him. I'm agnostic. I don't know. So let's dig into these contents. First of all, an introduction. Let's remember the flow of chapter 8. The first section in chapter 8 talks about how we are to wisely relate to human authorities. And he talks about the example of someone who is a king. They're in high authority. How are we to relate to a king if we are in the position to be an advisor, or if we're under their jurisdiction, but we're supposed to actually give input? That is the question that is answered in the first several verses. And so he talks about the wisdom of relating to a king. From that, he moves into the second section where he talks about relating wisely to the highest king, the highest authority, and that is God Himself. Now, whether we realize this or not, verses 9 through 14 are really connected to that particular matter, because what he's going to do is he's going to give illustrations or examples of the kinds of things that when we look at them, they perplex us, they frustrate us, we can't make sense of them. And he says, those are the kinds of things that trip people up. These are the kinds of things that cause people to become bitter and frustrated and angry at God. And they refuse to submit to His authority. These are examples of the kinds of things that cause us to stumble. And so this section recounts four examples of difficult circumstances that we all encounter or will encounter in life that are hard to work through in our minds. And I know we, as we read these, will go, yeah, I've seen one of those. Yeah, I'm dealing with that right now. I'm struggling with this. So let's move through them one at a time. The first example that's mentioned is found in verse number 9. I'm going to read the verse and then tell you what exactly it's saying. Verse number 9, it says this, all this have I seen and applied my heart unto every work that is done under the sun. There is a time wherein one man ruleth over another to his own hurt. Now you might say, what exactly is Solomon getting at in this verse? I'm going to give you a very simple statement. It's authority that goes bad. When authority goes bad, it causes us to stumble. Now, when I talk about authorities going bad, I could be talking about your dad. I could be talking about your mom. I could be talking about your husband. I could be talking about a boss that you have. I could be talking about a church situation that you lived through 20 years ago. There are lots and lots of different ways that we have authorities in our lives that when we watch these people, they let us down, they frustrate us, they discourage us, they weary us, and because of that situation that we've observed, we can't make sense of it, and it's something that really plagues us. It's like this ball and this chain that we drag through life that we can't make sense of, and often it comes up over and over and over again in our lives. So when I can't make sense of this in one area of life, it might be something I grew up with. Sometimes it affects my marriage. Sometimes it affects my relationship to my kids when they're little or maybe when they're grown. Or sometimes it affects my relationship to somebody in spiritual authority. Maybe it affects my relationship to a boss. But because of that situation that I had in the past that I did not resolve in my mind biblically, I struggle. But the struggle isn't ultimately with the person or the people or the institution that we saw. It's actually with God's willingness to allow it to unfold as it did. That's often where the struggle lies. Let's talk for a few minutes about this verse. Now, this verse is an interpretively challenging verse. What I mean by that is there are a couple different ways that you can go in your explanation of these verses. And when I say there's a couple different ways you can go, what I mean is you can legitimately go more than one way when it comes to this particular verse. So let's talk about the two different ways you could look at this. And I will mention this. In the two different ways you can go at this verse, the principle is the same in both. So there's some uncertainty about how to understand the statement, and let's dig into the details a little bit tonight. First of all, we need to think about the word ruleth, okay? Now that word ruleth could actually be looked at as a term that talks about a domineering kind of a ruling, or it could be just referring to the fact that there's authority structure. I'll give you an example of this. In Genesis chapter 2, and then in chapter 3, when Adam sins and Eve sins, God gives this instruction, or he talks about the fact that the world is going to be cursed. And he talks about the curse to the world, he talks about the curse to the serpent, he talks about the curse to Adam, and he talks about the curse to Eve. Okay? And so when he talks about the curse to Adam, he focuses in on the realm that Adam is primarily working in, which is what? It's the field. Okay, so when Adam goes into the field, thorns and thistles are going to come up. You're going to work by the sweat of your brow. You're going to be tired. You're going to be exhausted. So the curse is because sin's now in the world, you're going to get weary. You're going to get worn out. You're going to get frustrated. And in that relationship, what you're doing that God's given you, there's going to be a lot of frustration involved with that. So the job that God gave Adam wasn't a bad job, but there's frustration that's connected to that because of the fallen world. Now, when he talks about Eve, hers is a little bit different. He talks about the pain or the sorrow that's associated with child rearing or childbearing. He says, in sorrow, you'll conceive. And then he talks about her relationship to her husband. He says that the husband is going to rule over you and your desire will be to your husband. Now, that's a really interesting statement. If you were to dig into it in the original language and think about what it's saying, he's basically saying this. This relationship between husband and wife, which is a good one, okay? The authority structure in the home is something that came before the fall. That authority structure is now going to have pressure put into it because of sin. A wife is a sinner. A husband is a sinner, right? We're both sinners. So that means when there's conflict in the home as a husband, I'm often contributing a lot to it. And you know how I tend to contribute to the problems in my home? And probably you do too, men. We tend to be a little bit too domineering. So we are in the position of authority, but we abuse that authority because we're fallen people, we're sinners. And you know how women often contribute to the problems of their home? They try to take the authority that God's given to their husbands. And so when it says your desire will be to your husband, the idea is you're going to want to take his role. And husband, you're going to have a tendency to dominate in your role. Now, when he uses this word rule here, he could be using in the sense of simply an authority structure, or he could be talking about the fact that a person is domineering in the way that they're doing it. And what's interesting is that the way that this is translated in the Septuagint, which is a Greek translation of the Old Testament, is it uses a word that often is referred to as a domineering. So it's not just about authority structure, it's about domineering. So when the verse talks about a person ruling over another, he may simply say he's an authority, or he might be saying he's a domineering person, okay? Do you see how there are those two different possibilities there? And I'll give you an example of the harsh sense. Luke chapter 22. Verse 25, it says this. He said unto them, the kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and they that exercise authority upon them are called benefactors. But you shall not be so, but he that is greatest among you, let him be the younger, and he that is chief as he that doth serve. And so what's very interesting is what Jesus is referring to here is he's saying, when people are in authority, they tend to domineer or lord it over the people that are under them. And he says, if you're to be a godly leader, that's not how you're to lead. You bear responsibility as an authority person, but you're supposed to serve. So what you see in those verses are the tendency within a fallen world to domineer when you're in authority, and how God wants you to be serving when you're in a position of authority. Keep that in your mind, because there's a second word or second phrase that's very important here. And that is the phrase "to his own hurt." To his own hurt could be referring to one, to the one exercising the authority, or it could be referring to the one that's under the authority. And by the way, if you look at it in the original languages, it's very difficult to determine if, when it talks about the person that is to his own hurt, if it's talking about it being the leader who is getting hurt by his authority, or if it's the people that are under him. And you might say, well, oh, that's really easy to figure out, because we all know that when people are in authority, they tend to hurt the people that are under them, not the people under them tend to hurt the people that are over them. But that's not true. That's absolutely not true. Any moms or dads in here that, though your kids are under your authority, they've broken your heart? Any moms or dads in here that stayed up hour after hour after hour, month after month after month, and you're absolutely worn out because you are taking care of these children? Anybody ever been a boss that's trying to manage people that are very difficult and frustrating to work with? The fact is, sometimes the authority is the one who gets worn out, not the one who's under the authority. But it goes the other way too. In other words, in a fallen world, there are times that the person who is in authority domineers those who are under them, and they are abusive, they are harsh, they are cruel, they're vindictive, they crush the people that are under them. But then there's other situations where the people that are under authority, they weary and they wear out the one who's in authority. I'll give you an example like this. Anybody ever notice the way a president looks when they go into office and the way they look when they leave office? Anybody remember what Bill Clinton looked like when he took office? He was a young-looking guy. Barack Obama? George W. Bush? Now, Joe Biden, I don't know what to say there. I guess it's not even been a, has it even been a full year? I don't know. I don't even know what to say there. Sorry, I'm going to get myself in trouble. But something happens to these people in office. They age. Why is that? Because there is incredible pressure that comes with that kind of authority. And so, moms, dads, being a mom or dad's going to wear you out. It is. So the question we should ask in our mind is, what exactly is Solomon saying? Is he talking about a person in authority that crushes people under him, or is he talking about the fact that being in authority is wearisome at times? And the answer is, it could be either one. We really don't know. So explanation one is that the irony, that this is ironic, because the one in authority has the power. The power kind of ends with them, yet this person, as they execute this authority, as they manage a group of people, as they guide and as they do the work, it wears them down. And he says, it doesn't make sense, because the one who's in authority shouldn't be the one who's wearied, right? He's the one with the power. She's the one with the power. But that's not how it always works. On the other side, explanation two, the example that the irony, that it's an irony because the authority structure was designed by God for the good of people, for protection. Like, why did God give authority structure in a home? Because you can't have two people run a household. Somebody's got to make the decision. Somebody's got to call the shots. God has to choose somebody and say, you're responsible. And so if things aren't going right, dad, husband, that's on you, because you're not being the leader of your home. You're not assuming the role that God has assigned to you appropriately. And so we see that there's this concept that either one, a person is domineering, or two, a person is wearied in this process. And so what Solomon is basically saying is, you know, when I look at this concept of authority, sometimes I see leaders that are destroyed by the job. It just destroys them physically. It destroys them emotionally. It wearies their soul. It ages them. It ultimately kills them. He says, that doesn't make sense. And then I see people who are under authority, people who God's given them that are supposed to protect and supposed to guide and are supposed to carry the burden, the weight of responsibility, and they're crushing the people under them. He says, it doesn't make sense. And let me tell you something. There are some people that when they're under an abusive authority, that makes them very bitter against God. And there's plenty out there. We'll all be under somebody at some point in our lives that's a horrible authority. We will. Because this is a fallen world. Just, it's going to happen. Yet there are also people who they see what being in a position of responsibility can do to someone. You know how many pastors get burned out and become bitter against God? Because the work is very difficult. You know how many missionaries are jaded people? Because they went to the field with a passion, with a fervency, with a burden, and they're jaded. You know how many parents, like, by the time their kids are of age, are like, get out of my house. I don't want to deal with you anymore. I can't deal with this. And the point is, this is an irony of life. This is something that we experience. It's something that we observe. The point is that leading is not easy. Some people abuse their power. Even they harm people that are under them. Some people are destroyed by the physical and mental pressures of leading. And you say, well, how does this have connection to God and his authority? God's the one that creates authority structure. God's the one that puts people in power. God's the one that sometimes doesn't remove people, or he removes them, but it's a slow process. And so when we're dealing with complications as it relates to authority, we tend to become angry at God because he's the one who can remove that person, or he's the one that allowed them to come to power. He's the one that doesn't seem to be coming to our aid fast enough. I ask the question, does God have the right to be God in your life? Of course he does. Does he need to answer to you for what he does and doesn't do? Of course he doesn't. Example number two. I don't think we're going to get through all four tonight, but that's okay. This one's a really big one. You know how many people that do not go to church will tell you the reason they don't go is because all those people, they're hypocrites. You ever heard that? I know how those people are. They're all a bunch of hypocrites. You know what's sad is sometimes what they're saying is true. Sometimes a person who says that they were in a church situation where the people really were hypocrites. They were proud. They were self-righteous. They had their little box and they had their little niche and everybody else around them didn't fit their mold. They pretty much stuck their nose up to those people. There are churches where people show a lot of favoritism, a lot of partiality. If you've got money, if you've got a nice job, if you've got talents, you get this side. And if you don't, well, you kind of go over here. Sometimes people see religious hypocrisy. And in fact, it stinks terribly. And so you know what's interesting? Solomon talks about that. Look down at what he says in verse number 10. He says, I saw the wicked buried who had come and gone from the place of the holy. They were forgotten in the city where they had so done. This is also vanity. You go, what in the world is Solomon trying to say? In very simple terms, he's saying, I saw religious hypocrisy that did not appear to get dealt with in this life. It seemed like it was forgotten. And that's hard to see. It's like a person who, the way that they manage a ministry or the way that they pastor a church or the way that they raise funds as a missionary or the way that they manage their household or the way that they handled conflict, we look at those things and it appears as if they just kind of like, they're like Teflon. They just seem to get away with these things. And you go, that's just not right. That's irritating to watch. That's frustrating. That's unjust. That's evil. Notice the way this is worded. First of all, the person that he's talking about in these verses, he says this is a wicked person, okay? You couldn't say it a lot clearer than that. They're a wicked person. But what's ironic about the wicked person is that the wicked person who is now dead and buried is a person who used to go to a place where the holy go. You know what he's talking about? It's out by the temple. He said, and so here is this man or this woman, this person, that we all know they're a hypocrite. They go to the temple, they pay their vows, they do their sacrifice, they say their prayers, they give their alms, they play the part of a religious person. They interact with religious people, but when it comes to how they live their lives, it's the complete opposite of what they're doing in the temple. And so when he says that they're a wicked person and he says what they did in the city is forgotten, another way of saying it is, here's this person who lived a life of hypocrisy, religious hypocrisy, and now they're dead and gone. Everybody forgot about it. Like, who held this person to account? Who called them out and said, this is what you are? Who rebuked them? Who punished them? And Solomon goes, it's not right. That's not fair. Folks, this is something that we sometimes see in life. Now, please understand something. Just because you don't see justice doesn't mean there won't be justice. Okay? That's really important. Just because you don't see it doesn't mean it won't happen. Okay? God's eyes have observed all things. In fact, there will be some things that everybody thought we were very admirable in, and when we stand before Christ, it's going to be exposed that we weren't so admirable in those areas. I mean, when it comes down to parsing out our motivation and why we did what we did and how we went about doing it, you know, the people that got the accolades may not on the final analysis. God is just. God is righteous. He is going to do the right thing. But God's timetable and our timetable, they're not always the same. Just because a person goes to the grave and they keep their secrets hidden and everything's smooth and they never get rebuked and nothing ever comes out the way that you would assume that it should, does not mean that it's over. Yet there are many, many people that frankly are angry at God. And they hold this as a resentment against God because God did not meet their expectations. And how to deal with a religious hypocrite. Folks, I hope that your faith is in Christ and the gospel, not the people that attend the church, not the pastor who pastors the church, not the people that come into your life and leave who are in spiritual authority over the years. Now, I hope that when people are a part of the church, they are honest men and women of integrity. I hope that the people that are over you in spiritual authority are men of integrity, are people who do what's right and they do it for the right reason. But our faith should never be in those people. Our faith should always be in the gospel. The church will always be a flawed institution or organization, organism, I guess is a better word to use, because it's made up of people. As soon as you bring people together, you have sinners. Who have problems, who need to grow and who need to mature, and who are going to let you down. But this issue of religious hypocrisy, in fact, is something that is a huge weight. I will just say this. Let's be purpose not to be a stumbling block to somebody. That's a big deal. Let's not put all of our confidence in the people that God uses in our lives. And when God doesn't measure out as we believe he should, let's not indict him. What we don't see doesn't mean it won't happen. God is just. Example number three. Maybe I'll move quickly through these. We'll see. A government that neglects its duties. I'm sure you all have been hearing about what's going on in California these days. People are working in stores, and all of a sudden, this mob of individuals comes running in, basically beats up people that are working there. They steal whatever they want. It's like a loot and run. It's happening over and over and over again. Why is it happening? Very simple. Because the government isn't doing their job. They are not doing their job. When somebody commits a crime, they're not being held accountable for the crime. And so when you're in a position of authority and your job is to be just and you're not just, guess what you do? You embolden the wicked. This is a huge problem in our country right now. It's a huge problem because people have a false view of human nature. That's part of it. But listen carefully to what it says in verse 11. This isn't really about politics. It's just, let's read what it says. He says, because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. One of the simplest examples of this is you heard the story about a man who drove into a crowd with his vehicle and killed people just a short time ago. Do you know how many times that guy was arrested for assault and attempted murder? Do you realize he tried to run over and kill his ex-girlfriend just a few months before what he did to that crowd? Folks, people like that shouldn't be on the streets. You embolden evil when you don't deal with it. And nobody in here has the authority to do that, okay? But we see that and we go, what's going on? God created government to protect the innocent. Listen to what it says in Romans chapter 13, verse 1. He says, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers. For there is no power but of God, the powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. That word damnation doesn't mean you're going to hell if you disobey the government. He's saying you're going to be judged, okay? You're going to face the court. He says, for rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. This is talking about God's design for government. He says, wilt thou not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, thou shalt have praise of the same. For he is the minister of God to thee for good. For he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon them that do evil. To put it very simply, God instituted government to punish evil and to defend the innocent. So what happens when the government doesn't punish evil and defend the innocent? Well, all of a sudden, guess what we have? We have chaos. We have frustration. And we see that every generation in human history has observed this kind of a thing. You know, it's very interesting. We can look at American history, study American history. And we love our country. I love our country. It's an amazing country. There's never been a country like it ever. Yet we can see examples of our own government being very unjust at seasons throughout the way. Examples of this kind of a thing not happening the way that it should. When the government does not restrain evil, it perpetuates it. And this is one of those paradoxes. We look at this irony and we go, how do I make sense of this? Example number four. Principled people who suffer. I think this is probably one of the most difficult things that any of us face. You see a person that you love and you know walks with God and they get cancer. And that person suffers. They live many, many years with a chronic illness. And when we look at that, we go, that's just not just. It's not right. How is it that this person who doesn't care about God, who doesn't love the ways of the Lord, who lives in a way that is unjust and ungodly, how is it that God gives them good health and strength and they live to be 95 years old? And then here is this godly young lady or this godly young man, this person who wants to give their life to the service of the Lord, and they end up with a chronic illness and they're in pain and they're in suffering for all this time and they die at a young age, or they don't die at a young age, but they live a life of suffering and difficulty. And we look at that and we go, that's not right. Listen to what he says in verse 12. Though a sinner do evil 100 times and his days be prolonged, yet surely I know that it shall be well with them that fear God, which fear before him. But it shall not be well with the wicked, neither shall he prolong his days, which are as a shadow, because he fears not before God. There is a vanity which is done upon the earth, that there be just men unto whom it happeneth according to the work of the wicked. Again, there be wicked men unto whom it happeneth according to the work of the righteous. I said, this is also vanity. And what Solomon's communicating is, he says, in my mind, you do right, there should be blessing. You do wrong, there should be struggle and hardship and difficulty. Proverbs 11, verse 10. When it goes well with the righteous, the city rejoices. When the wicked perish, there is shouting. That's a really interesting proverb, is it not? If the righteous are thriving and prospering in a city, that city's in a good place. You know why he says that? Because righteous people thrive in just societies. But on the other side, righteous people are oppressed in unjust societies. Does that make sense? So if a society is functioning in a just manner, then people who do right are going to thrive. But if a society is corrupt, guess what? Righteous people suffer. In other words, in our minds, we believe that industry should produce prosperity. Righteousness should produce a good quality of life. Faithfulness should produce thriving relationships. And as a general rule, that is true. But in a fallen world, there are exceptions. For instance, in Matthew 5:10, Jesus said, "Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when men shall revile you and persecute you and say all manner of evil against you falsely. For my sake, rejoice and be exceeding glad. Great is your reward in heaven, for so persecuted they the prophets which were before you." Do you see what we have? As a general rule, the righteous prosper. But there are also many circumstances where they suffer. Some societies and contexts are terribly unjust. Some Christians experience very difficult suffering as a direct result of their righteousness. When the evil prosper, it appears, that living a measured godly life doesn't provide temporal benefits. And in some cases, it doesn't. Principled people sometimes pay for their willingness to be principled. And there are times in life that we see this play out and we go, that's something I can't get past. This is one of those areas, one of those ironies that Solomon's addressing. In all of these examples, we see situations that when we observe them, it makes us uncomfortable. And by the way, I don't think it's wrong for it to make us uncomfortable. However, we can't stay there. We've got to respond properly to God when we see these things. So you say, well, how should we respond to what we've seen here? Let me give you a couple of simple thoughts in closing. The first one is this, and I think this is a really important principle for us to learn in life. Recognize that life does not follow a rigid pattern or formula. Now, if you'd asked me 20 years ago if I believe that, I would say, absolutely, I believe that. But that's not true. It's just not true. The book of Ecclesiastes could not be clearer on that matter. Life is not throw in the formula and you get the result you want. It doesn't work that way. People have wills. They can make choices that are good or bad. You can give people all kinds of opportunity and guess what they can do? They could walk away from it to your utter shock and amazement. It's true. And you look and you go, how in the world could you make such a decision? And they do it. There are some people you say there's absolutely no way they're going to make the right choice there. And to your utter shock and amazement, God gets a hold of their attention. And you go, wow, I'm pleasantly surprised. Life can be very surprising. I want to encourage you, don't be discouraged or shocked when you observe these ironies. One of the reasons that people can become wiser as they get older is that they're able to observe lots of situations and they're kind of able to see not just the immediate consequence, but the long-term consequence. How do things flush out? This is what people who study history learn. When you study history, you see when this happens, here's the ultimate outcome. That is a valuable insight for us to have. This is why studying history is so important. This is why studying biblical history is so important. This is why listening to older people is so important. And so we should make sure that we don't become discouraged or shocked when we see the things that are going on. This is the kind of world we live in. We need to recognize that God is not bound to our timetables or expectations. You know, it's interesting. You have two people, they get married. Why do they get married? Oh, because they're in love. At least that's what they're calling it at that season of life. But it's amazing how quickly they start having conflicts. And you say, well, what's the source of the conflicts? A lot of times it's expectations. And they never even think that these are expectations. What, you mean that you're not going to cook all my meals? Like, my mother always cooked all of my meals. You mean I got to iron my shirt? I never saw my dad iron a shirt one time in my entire life. Some people grow up in households like that. Some people grow up in households, their mom never ironed a shirt once for their dad. Well, let me tell you something. You come from two households like that, and then you get married. Guess what happens? You never, when you got married, told your wife, I expect you to cook my meals and iron my shirt. But you thought it. You just didn't know it. Because you found out that that's what you were thinking when she didn't iron your shirt. And she said, hey, why don't you grill tonight? Now, you know, we're laughing about this because, you know, most of us, we've kind of gotten past that, right? We have expectations for God too, though. And these expectations put us in the center of the universe and we don't even realize it. And so when we start observing situations or we start living through circumstances that shake us up a little bit, all of a sudden we recognize, I had an expectation about God that I never even understood. We need to recognize God isn't bound to our timetables and our expectations. The fact that he allows circumstances to unfold different than our own expectations does not mean he is unjust, unloving, or less than good. We haven't seen the whole picture. We don't understand necessarily why he did what he did. We need to humble ourselves before God. I put some, these are tough to swallow, but I'm going to put them out there. We need to stop clinging to our rigid expectations. We need to stop assuming that we have it all figured out in life. I think some of us are past that one already, but we need to. We need to stop assuming that we need to stop living as if God owes us something. I mean, every Sunday we come in here and we're reminded of the grace of God. Grace means I don't deserve the good things I have. And it all starts with the gospel, and from the gospel it goes to everything else that I enjoy in my life. We need to stop living as if God is answerable to us. Let's humble ourselves and submit to his ways and gratefully invest our time in our energies and what he's given us. A great example of this is what we looked at in the life of David. David was a super flawed guy in so many ways. But when it came to this issue of building the temple and God said no, when David was an old man, you know what he did? He said, I'm going to give all my attention to helping my son do what God said I can't do. And that's the way we need to live our lives. If God says no, accept it. And give all your time and energy to what he says, here's what I've got for you. I hope that these truths will encourage and help you. Let's bow for prayer tonight. Father, thank you for the time we've spent in the Bible. Help us to understand these truths. Help them to settle in our hearts. And I pray that the work that the Holy Spirit does through these things would not leave us, but it would continue to press into our hearts day after day for many, many months and years to come. We ask it in Christ's name, amen.